up all their hay and everything.
What is up, Angry Nation? I can take the old man glasses off now that you guys are here. I have a reflection in your eyes. So it's myself, your favorite Angry American, and Mr. Sue LaRue right now. What's up, Sue?
I did get a text from our other two musketeers. They're currently in their vehicles, so they will be joining us shortly as soon as they get to their houses.
You had that pretty close to correct, but you're a little off. It's not musketeers, it's musky queers. Especially when we're talking about those two. Musky queers. Remember that. So I did one earlier today. We did a pre-record with Ed T in here. And he was on time. And today, now this evening, you know, the normal time, he's gonna be late. So and you think Emery's gonna show up? Emery gonna be here?
Yeah, he's on his way to Carl Erickson's house right now, so he should nice. Be showing up here in a few minutes. But I just wanted to kind of obliterate that musketeers and musky queers is both sounds French. So
it sure does. They're very French in origin. Yeah, I'll agree with you. Yeah. The frogs came up with both of them for sure. So. Let me see. I'm just checking shit, guys. Bear with me for a minute.
This is a good time for my my language lesson that I learned in Special Forces there. You know, I learned how to speak French many years ago, and then I ended up going to the Middle East, and then I ended up going to Russia right when the wall came down and everything. And I kind of noticed something, you know, speaking just a little bit of the languages, both Arabic and Russian. But do you know what the French word for bathe or shower is?
It's douche. That's right.
Yeah. And in Arabic, the word for shower or bathe is douche. Yep. And in Russian, the word for shower or bathe is douche. So what does that tell you about the history?
That tells you that none of those people took a bath till Napoleon got there.
Killed my punchline.
That tells you. Okay. Yeah. Well, no, I was sending it home for you. It shows you that none of those people, the Russians, the Arabs, none of those people had a term for bathing their bodies. Until the French showed up, and they're known for being very clean and smelling good. You know, the French are. So that's awesome, Sue.
Well, it comes to you bring up this now.
Yeah. They're not exactly. Yeah, so. And it's funny that it was the French because they're notoriously smelly people. You know, they almost got the 60-second.
But the Arabs and the Russians. The Arabs and the Russians, they do not like to be, you know, they don't like that when you bring that up.
No. So Norm Blakeney on here says, Biden, first incumbent in 60 years to lose a primary in Samoa. That's cool. I mean, I like the Samoans. I think they're awesome people. And I like them even more now. Where do you stand on the election, Sue? What's going to happen in November? What do you think is going to happen in November?
Nikki Haley finally dropped out. I was kind of, you know, a couple months ago, I was hoping that she would be on the short list for VP. But now that I've kind of seen her true colors and you know, she's all about the world economy, I'm kind of glad she's not on the list. And she did not. When she dropped out today, she suspended her campaign, but she did not endorse Trump. That makes me very nervous. And I'm thinking that I hope she doesn't come back in a third party or try to take some of the votes like what happened. That, which is the only reason Clinton got in, you know. I hope something like that doesn't happen in the on the Republican side. But I think the American people spoke loudly. Yeah, very clearly.
I don't think Haley has a chance in hell of running on a third party ticket. She was so thoroughly, completely, and totally trounced in the primaries that she doesn't have. I mean, what aspirations at this point she can even have? No one wants her. You know, she, like you said, she showed her true colors. She showed who she really is. So it's gonna be interesting. I noticed Biden's making a sweep of the Democratic primaries, but the Democrat primaries. He's kind of sweeping those, which I thought was hilarious. Let me see. Patrick here says, I have a theory that all the communists are going to vote for Trump. They want him to win so they can riot and force through the revolution. And the left doesn't realize they're being used, and the right thinks the communists are the left. Yeah, you got some points in there for sure, Patrick. But I think the left knows what they're doing. I think the right can't get their shit together to mount a defense. And it's going to be interesting to see how things shake out. And if I sound digitized and all, guys, I'm in a hotel in New Orleans. Apologize. Just had dinner with Mel and her mom and her aunt. And I'm back in a hotel until we head back for Florida tomorrow. I can't wait to get the fuck out of here.
Did you make it to the new World War II Museum over there?
Not this trip. The last time I was here, though, me and Mel did it. We spent several hours in the World War II Museum, and it was fantastic. Now, they've been building or are building that new expansion, and I want to go see that when it's available. But, you know, Mel's mom lives here now. Her sister lives here now. So I guess there's more New Orleans in my future, as much as I hate to say that. Not a big fan of this place, so. Royale with cheese. Right time of year.
Midsummer.
Yeah, it's not bad.
Time to be in New Orleans. No, yeah.
No, dude. That summer heat descends on this place, and that humidity fills this goddamn swamp up. It is miserable down here in the summertime.
Yeah. Yeah, and I'm no fan of Bourbon Street, the place that smells like puke and piss.
Like straight up, just human urine and vomitus. That's what's all over the street down there. And then the kind of people you have to deal with down there. It's interesting that, like, the locals, they bring the kids out. And they put the kids out on Bourbon Street drumming on five-gallon buckets. And if you don't tip them when you walk by, they start screaming that you're racist. Because all the little kids are black. Just a fact. It's the way it is. I'm not making a statement about it, but that's just what it is. And if you walk past them and you don't tip them, then they start screaming racist at you, which is, I guess, their angle, you know, white guilt to get money. And I just fucking laugh at them as I walk by. I'm not tipping them shit. But, I can't stand being here, dude. And I want out of here. Ma's in the house. What's up, Ma? How you doing? We're heading home tomorrow, Ma, just so you know. Got to keep Mom up to date. And Hombre, we will be in Bowling Green on the 23rd. We will be there. Russ and Teresa will be there. I'll be there. Mel will be there. So we'll be hanging out. What have you been up to today, Sue? I mean, and in case you guys haven't caught on yet, tonight's live, there is no guest. It's just us talking shit. And we're waiting on the rest of the idiots so we can start talking shit about them. Or we can start early, Sue. We're going to talk shit about Emery and T now that they're not here to defend themselves. I mean, we could do that.
I did talk to Emery this afternoon. And I used all my Jew jokes then, so I better leave him alone. His feelings are hurt right now, so
he'll
give me back. Yeah,
yeah. It went a little too hard to paint, did you? Yeah. You'll have that.
Yeah. So last weekend I was at a tracking class in Yeah, in Morrow Mountain State Park in North Carolina, here in North Carolina, and we had a bunch of game wardens, some state police, and a whole lot of first responders out there in the class. It was a really good time. And Charlie Williams, who's, you know, with Pineland Resources, he'll be there at the May event. And I really encourage people to sign up for the class. I really like the way that Charlie approaches teaching tracking, because I was raised to the step-by-step method, you know, like you were.
Right.
You and I both have gone through the step-by-step method. And, you know, you show up for 3 days and you follow, you learn a lot about checking during the step-by-step method. But the problem is, at the end of 3 days, you've only gone 100 yards or 150 yards, you know, and you see every single track. I really like Charlie's approach to it, where he you know, you follow one team, and as a team, you follow another team, and then you kind of work your way into just following one guy, and then you go into the step-by-step method. So people's confidence is high that, you know, the track is actually there and they can follow it. And then when they get, when, you know, 3 or 4 days later, he gets into the step-by-step method. And I'm like, man, that's a different approach that I haven't heard of. But I really enjoy it. And I can see, you know, kind of stepping back and watching the students that they all leave in just in 3 days, or this is going to turn out to be a 5-day course. We're going to go back this weekend and teach the other half of the tactical part of it. But I can see confidence building in the students, you know, instead of, you know, the step-by-step method. How many in your class or my class or the classes I used to teach, half the people were like, well, I really can't get this. I'm not so sure. We didn't go very far. This will never work, you know, and type thing. But I hope to, I told you I was going to try to write a book. I really want to include that comparison in you know, in the front of the book. So.
You need to do that. And it makes sense, because essentially what you're doing is, You're trying to identify a single track, a unique track that you can pick out of whatever that formation is. And then once you've identified that track, that's when you're going to step by step, right? Because prior to that, you're basically casting the wide net. You're throwing the wide net, looking for everything you can get until you find something that is unique that you can zero in on and follow that track. So,
yep.
But yeah, that's a cool idea. I liked it.
Yeah, that's why I like Charlie's approach. You want the students to understand that no matter where people walk, they're going to leave some kind of sign, you know. So he starts out with a large group of people and then slowly gets them following sign until they're on one person, and they says, okay, now the time is to fall back on the step-by-step method. You're still using your tracking stick and everything, but then when you get just following one line of sign, you understand why the tracking stick's important. So that's a different approach. And, you know, we both did the Ab Taylor or the Joel Harden method years ago, but I really like the twist he put on it, and I shouldn't say better, but it's a different approach that I think is more digestible to a brand new student learning tracking.
I would agree. And since you mentioned tracking sticks, Sue, let's go ahead and tell everybody what a tracking stick is, because most folks have no fucking idea what you're talking about when we say tracking stick.
A tracking stick looks like a walking stick or a ski pole. Okay. And a lot of people think it came from the Border Patrol, but Ab Taylor and Joel Harden, both, you know, Border Patrol agents, will tell you that it was not the Border Patrol that came up with that. It was actually search and rescue guys out there in the Southern California, Chula Vista, El Centro area, who used to go out there and, you know, kids, you know, back when we had three wheelers, not four wheelers and motorcycles, bunch of kids would go out there on that desert and they'd get lost, you know, so they'd go and try to find these guys. Well, they search and rescue guys came up with this stick. They always saw Joel Harden or Ab Taylor walking they used a walking stick, right? But it was really the search and rescue guys who developed a way that if they take the stick and they put O-rings or markers on the stick, that they could point the point of the stick to the heel of the next sign you want to see, and then your two markers go over the footprint that you can see. And it kind of gives you a stride length and everything. So instead of looking at the whole canvas of the ground and catching all kinds of distractors, where you put that stick down and you wave it in a 60 degree arc, and it kind of points you to where your next footprint should be, right? And it really helps out. You learn a lot faster that way. And I think it's in several other people's curriculum now to start out with the tracking stick. Now, of course, when you talk about getting into tactical things like I did in the military or law enforcement doing a felon pursuit, you don't want to have a tracking stick and have your carbine, you know, slung over your rifle. Your M4 or your carbine becomes your tracking stick, you know. So.
Yeah, we used to I used a different method with tracking sticks. I used the O-ring thing because I would put my tracking stick at the toe of the last recognizable track. And then I would adjust the O-rings on the stick to fit the next track in it. So the same thing, like you said, but it made for a shorter stick. I could usually cut my stick down a few inches and it had to be as long because I wasn't coming from the heel of the last track, but from the toe of the last track, looking for the heel of the next track is how I did it. And I had the O-rings on there. Same thing, slide them up and down so they fit. And like you said, when you swing that stick, it changes your perception and what you see when you're moving it across the track path, you know, because it focuses whatever, it focuses your vision.
Yep. And whatever works. And I, you know, people think, well, tracking takes years to learn. No, it doesn't. Tracking does not take a long time to learn. All right. And, you get better at it with practice. It's like anything else. It's like shooting baskets or, you know, shooting with a handgun or something like that. The more practice you get at it, the better you get at it. But tracking is nothing more than just paying attention to detail. I like to tell people that, you know, remember when you were a toddler and grandma or your mom was reading a book to you, you'd see the pictures on the page, but all that writing underneath, you could see it, but you couldn't read it, right? That's all you're doing when you're looking for tracks is you're learning how to read the sign that's already there that you can already see and recognize it as human footfall. Does that make sense?
Yep. Yeah. It's looking for those minor disturbances of the surface. So like when you walk on grass will fall same direction you're walking generally. Mud, obviously these tracks. But two, people don't realize like the tracks that are the sign that's created unintentionally, like where you take a step and say in mud and your next step, that mud could fall off the bottom of your boot and land mid track. So now we've got something, obviously it's not natural. That wasn't there. The rain in the sky didn't create that. And it's just learning how to, like you just said, interpret what you're looking at in front of you. There's little things of, you know, bent grass, all that stuff, broken twigs, you know, leaves that are knocked off, or even the amount of moisture that may be in a track compared to the dirt around it, you know. So everybody should take a track class because it's not all about like Sue was saying, not all about tactical stuff, but you know, search and rescue, you know, of a child goes missing. I mean, how cool would it be to have someone experienced in tracking at that scene immediately who could be like, well, here's where he went. Let's follow him and see where he goes. So it's a valuable skill and it's fun too. Like, I had my girls into it when they were young. We would go out and track deer and raccoons and stuff like that. And I made them learn how to read tracks just for that purpose.
In your books, you've got 12 volumes there. And I think at least twice that I can remember, you talked about the community in those books. They would go to certain spots around the community to see if there was any sign of passage, you know, people trying to sneak up on the community, and those are called track traps. And that, you know, that's where I got into it. I was a prison guard, and when I was flunking out of college there in Arizona, and we would have inmates actually rake both sides of the fence 8 feet.
Yep.
And then at night we would just drive around that prison and shine a spotlight to see if anything had entered that 8 foot to the fence and 8 foot on the other side of the fence. You know, you can just see it plain as day. Plain as day. So it's great.
They run rakes and like discs and stuff around the perimeters of a lot of facilities. Cool. Like you said, just to keep the material disturbed. And because if you step on it, even if you try the old cowboy movie of dragging the branch behind you with all the leaves and you're going to rake out your tracks, that still leaves a track. That still leaves a different impression.
That leaves more track. That leaves more.
It leaves way more.
I was in Ranger school and it would just frustrate me because that was the method that we'd go when we crossed the fire break, you know, and you got 20 guys in your patrol. The last guy had to grab a branch and rub it on the road. And I would get mad about that. And my instructors are like, what are you getting mad about? I know. And I would say, because the other instructors are coming down the road in a Jeep or, you know, a Chevy Blazer, drinking coffee and donuts, and they see all that, those pine needles and all the scratches in the road, and they're like, oh, they just went there. It just shows them exactly where we're going.
Yeah.
We stood a better chance of just taking a shirt off or something and waving it over there and just trying to use. There's two things that age the track the quickest, and one of them is not rain. It's actually sunlight and wind. So if you can just
sunlight and wind,
or a shirt and just kind of swish it over there and mix the dirt up, you stand a better chance of eliminating your tracks versus leaving them, you know, using a branch and putting a whole bunch of other scratches and debris out in the road that, you know, that most people know were never there before.
Well, so, like one of the best ways is to pull your ponchos out, because we all carry ponchos on our rucks, right? Yes. Right. So pull your ponchos out and you lay those out across the road. Everybody walks across them. Last guy picks up the last poncho until he crosses the road, and everybody rolls their shit up, puts it away. You'll still leave impressions. You'll still leave sign, but it won't be as visible. You're familiar with caterpillar shoes, right? Carpet shoes that the coyotes use, and the smuggler shoes. Yeah.
All the mules carrying the drugs, they wear carpet shoes. Yeah. But you can still see them if you know what to look for. Yeah.
Yeah. If you know what you're looking for. Yeah. And so you got to learn what looks like natural sign and what looks like unnatural sign. So, but yeah, our tracking is a lot of fun. And I'm looking forward to mountain readiness, because I want to hang out with you and Charlie while you guys are doing the class. I'm looking forward to that. That's going to be fun.
Cool. Yeah. So yeah, I hope we fill up the list. We're going to do a class right after mountain readiness, and I'm looking forward to showing everybody how easy it is to actually teach yourself how to track. You know, so
yeah, it's not hard and it's fun. Like, you know, you could do it on your walk during the day. Like, you're out, just whatever, you take a daily walk. That's a great time to practice tracking, just to identify what tracks you can see, start picking up disturbances, all the stuff that goes into tracking.
Yeah. Especially for a man like me, you know, it's a cheap hobby, because I was paying so much alimony and child support. I didn't have any money to have any hobbies. So tracking was natural hobby for me to get into.
Yeah, Sue was really good at marrying housekeepers, guys, because they all kept the house when he divorced them.
Exactly.
Sue was ready to marry a housekeeper for a while. So John Simmons in the house. What is up, my brother? How the fuck you doing, dude? It's good to see you in here. It's a good guy, Sue. You'd love the shit out of this dude. Like, good people. We'll be down in there's a fall event in Georgia called with Georgia Bushcraft. And we will be there this year for sure. I'm gonna make sure I make it. So let me see here. What do you think about Nikki Haley dropping out, Sue?
Well, like I said, I don't know why she didn't endorse Trump right there during that speech when she suspended her campaign. I mean, it kind of shows me. I mean, she did a great job as the ambassador at the UN. I thought she did a great job. Yeah. But during her campaign, I really listened to a lot of what she had to say and everything. And I'm sorry, guys. I was in the military almost 30 years, 28 years, 9 months, and I've been to all these places that people talk about, and we should not, the United States should not be the world's policeman. And Nikki Haley believes we should just blow all of our wealth, our money, our taxpayer dollars. We should just be propping up all these other countries. And I'm sorry, we really can't. That's unsustainable. We can't be doing that anymore.
We can't afford to prop up this country, let alone prop up anybody else. Did you see the pictures today that came out of Victoria Nuland, like from just a few years ago to what she looks like now? Have you seen that on Twitter or anything today?
No.
Dude, Victoria Nuland just a few years ago was an attractive young lady. The Victoria Nuland of today is a hellish bog monster of some variety. She's a terrible looking thing. Like, she's awful looking, dude. Like, like you look at what she was and what she is, you're like, how'd that happen? And I think it's just because Victoria Nuland's just like Nikki Haley in that she's never met a war she didn't like. And she has started numerous wars. Like, Ukraine is solidly in Victoria Nuland's lap. She started this shit. But you know, seeing those people physically change over time is kind of bizarre. And Nikki Haley, I mean, she used to be a young brown girl, and now she's a white chick, so I don't know. Apparently the change could be rather dramatic, so.
Right. Well, and then, like I said, I'm glad to see that she's actually not on the short list for VP, which I probably,
yeah, right?
We probably won't. We won't hear Trump's decision until July, which is the convention for the Republican Party. But I think, in my opinion, Tulsi Gabbard on there. I really like her for some. I mean, if you want to bring the people back together, she used to be a moderate Democrat. Okay. But if you, that's happened before, you know. Did you know that Abe Lincoln's Vice President Johnson, he picked Johnson for his second term because Johnson was a Democrat. Johnson was from the South. He was from Tennessee. Mm-hmm. So Abe Lincoln actually put Johnson as his VP choice for the reasons he knew the Civil War was about to end, for bringing the country back together. I think Trump would really, really... if you follow that example, he'd really do well if he picked Tulsi Gabbard.
I think Tulsi would be a good option for him because, you know, first it's the woman thing, you know, and apparently that has to happen every time now. But then, you know, she's a solid proponent of 2A and stuff like that. Like, I don't have a beef with Tulsi. I would take her in a heartbeat. But I think Vivek is a viable VP candidate too, because he ran a good race and he was the first guy to step out too. Like, he's a smart dude. He's like, all right, this is obviously not gonna happen for me. I'm not gonna keep wasting my money, and he stepped away. So I think Vivek is an option too for VP.
Or at least and Vivek doesn't get VP, I think he should at least be in the cabinet, like Department of Interior or even State Department, because the one thing I liked on Vivek's message was he's going to downsize government, not by just trying to fire onesies and twosies in the civil service, but he's going to get rid of entire agencies that really have outgrown their usefulness. And I really like, I think if we gave him Department of Interior, we'd see a lot of these stupid regulations and these self promoting ice cream cones, you know, like the EPA and you know, like the Bureau of Indian Affairs and Department of Agriculture. I think he would get rid of a lot of those regulations that are just nothing but, you know, hurdles for successful people, you know, to become successful. Is that, you know, nobody even wants to start a small business anymore, because as soon as you get started, you're already paying Uncle Sam, or hell, you need half of your startup costs are paying the government and going through all the permitting processes. It's just ridiculous. Yep. But if you're immigrant, you know, a legal immigrant, not an illegal immigrant, but if you're an immigrant, you got the Small Business Administration and everybody else just giving money to these people to start small businesses. Whereas if you're a Native American or somebody that's born here, they expect you to go out and raise the money and then give Uncle Sam their cut before you even get started. It's just unfair. I think Vivek would get rid of that kind of stuff.
Yeah, it'd be good to see him delete, like, Department of Education. Like, that needs to go. Like, the federal government should have – they shouldn't even have purview over that. That's a 10th Amendment issue, in my opinion. That should go the ATF, FBI, DHS, EPA. I could list a whole slew of them that need to go, and maybe there needs to be something in their places, but not the current iteration of those entities, in my opinion. Like, they need to be scrapped entirely.
I totally agree.
Not especially on the
Department of Education, we need to that should all that money that they've collected, or if there's still any in the kitty, needs to go back to the states. And then let the states compete for the next generation of where they want to raise a family and how they want to educate their kids. So, for example, like Vermont went to Nikki Haley, you know, and Super Tuesday last night. Well, no young couple's going to want to take their kids and raise their kids in Vermont. They're going to go to other states that have a more of a common sense approach to the way the countries ought to be run, and they're going to bring their kid. They're going to move to that state, and they're going to. If the states compete for that jaunder, or you know, the young couples that are starting to raise a family, if states compete with that, then they're looking long term to increase their state and their livelihood. So I think you're exactly right. Let the states compete with the education.
Well, but only if they did, though. And it seems like so many of the states these days are more like, your children aren't your children, they're our children, and they're doing stuff to drive people away, you know, as far as education and things like that. When you look at some of the studies and stuff that are coming out where they talk about how, and it goes contrary to the actual data that the studies provide about how parents should have no input whatsoever in educating the children. Like, that's the current, you know, WEF style thinking, is that the parents should have zero input. They shouldn't be involved in the process whatsoever. That the state, capital S, is the one that knows what your children need to be taught, and they'll do it for you. And that's gets us to where we are today with the current fucked up society we have, for everything that's going on, from, you know, gender ID to what the fuck ever, is because people have let, for a little while, I think there's a good solid 10 to 20 year period there where people did just let the state teach their children. And now we're looking at the blowback from it. You know, Sue, I mean, when I went to school, it was different than when this last iteration of kids went through in the last, like I said, 10 years, 20 years, probably. They changed what they were being taught, you know, and it went from being taught fundamental critical thinking skills to being taught ideology. And that's right. What we're seeing manifest now is all these kids that were taught ideology and talking points and not critical thinking or actual life skills. They were taught Marxist communist philosophy BS. And that's why we're seeing.
Or to be a victim. Yeah. Or to be a victim. Yeah. Yeah.
Same. Well, that's the same shit. That's the perpetual victim mentality. You know, those that are victims their entire life simply because they exist. It's like, I saw a comment by Dave Chappelle the other day where he was talking about how come he's a black man and he's oppressed. And I was just sitting there thinking, like, at what point in Dave Chappelle's life has he ever been oppressed? Like, the guys, he's been golden his whole life. He saw controversy, sure, but he's for the right reasons. Not because he was out screwing somebody he shouldn't have been, but because of the way he thinks. And I'm all about controversy for the way people think. Even if I disagree with them, I'll support their right thinking. But like, that dude's never been oppressed a day in his life. He's had, you know, he had the golden goose early on. You know, Comedy Central gave him, or whoever it was, gave him his own TV show way back years ago, guys. We're talking decades at this point. So that dude's never wanted for shit. But the perpetual victim crowd, that mentality, is it doesn't matter how successful they are, they're still victims. They're still oppressed. And they still need, I don't know what it is they need, but they still need more. Because, you know, equal means more for them.
Well, they brought back racism. They brought racism back. Because those
they
need somebody to blame. They need an enemy.
Yes.
And I'll give an example. Just recently, I was sitting down, you know, at the kitchen counter with my cousin, and he has two twin girls, beautiful girls, both of them. One of them has a 4.0 grade average, and there was a stack of acceptance letters from all the colleges around our area here in Western North Carolina. And of course, she got one from Boulder, you know, at Boulder, Colorado. We threw that in the trash before she saw it. But none of them try that one. But the one I tried to talk her into when Anna came in the room, I was like, "Hey, you really need to look at Florida State University." And she goes, and I said, "Can you handle it?" She goes, "Oh, I hate the cold. I said, "Yeah, if you can handle the heat, you need to go down there and really look at, you know, out of state tuition." Of course, my cousin wasn't happy about that, but I said, "There's other ways to get around that out of state tuition." But the one thing I loved about Ron DeSantis in the last couple of weeks is he went and he said, any university or community college that gets state funding, all your DEI positions are gone. Diversity, equity, and inclusion. Those positions are now gone in secondary education because that's a waste of time. And I just love that about Ron DeSantis, that he made that move, and he put it, he understands about education, and he understands that the brainwashing, even for the kids that come to a conservative or, you know, a, you know, homeschooling or parochial school in their K-12, they get stuck with the same brainwashing as soon as they get to college, you know, and
he understands.
Especially when you're young like that, and everything's clicking, you're trying to be out on your own and everything, and you just, he understands, trash in, trash out. If you hear that every day, mm-hmm. only secondary, he's like, these guys need to concentrate on education and not on, you know, creating victims and diversity. Or she will get a 4.0. I'm confident of that. But somebody who gets a 2.5 and stuff like that, they get placed over her because they have a different color skin or they got a darker tan. That's ridiculous. That's absolutely ridiculous.
They check more diversity boxes, so therefore they're better people. It's screwed up. The whole thing is, you know, this society, I don't know how much longer this broken fucking machine can limp along. And I don't know if you're seeing it, but I'm seeing a little lagging on my end. So I don't know if you guys are seeing it or not. I'm like, oh, holy shit, looky there.
What's up, guys?
Look, he finally decided to bless us with his presence.
Stop it.
I feel so special. I feel, inshallah, I feel so special.
Alhamdulillah.
How you doing, brother? How the fuck you been, man?
You know, crazy, running ragged. But good. It's nice to be on with you guys again. I'm sorry I've been gone forever, but I've literally.
What have you been doing? Yeah, you have been gone. I mean, and like, guys, this is legit. I'm asking what he's been doing because I don't fucking know either. So, what the fuck you been doing?
Yeah, we haven't talked in a minute.
I know you've been hopping. So.
Yeah, I've been to Israel a couple times now since the war started, and you know, classes here, classes there, and everything in between, and. Just a big old mess and dealing with the war from over here. And so I just got back from Israel a little over a week ago and then went right into military training for a week. So no rest for the wicked, but that's how we like it.
Hey, man, how's your back, bro?
You know what? Magically, for now, you know, knock on wood, we're doing okay.
Awesome, bro. Okay. Awesome. But, that's good.
What's what am I stepping into? What are we talking about?
We've been bitching about universities and education and politicians and tracking and all kinds of shit, man. So you're fitting right in, you know. You're a chewed puzzle piece. You fit in here like the rest of us. So
I'm conformable.
very much so. You know, those puzzle pieces, once they've been chewed up, they get soft because they get wet. Right. You can press them into pretty much whatever shape you want them to be. So. You work out well here.
I always used to tell my soldiers, you know, if it doesn't work with force, it'll work with brain or brawn and brain. And if it doesn't work with brain, it'll work with more force. And if that doesn't work, use violence.
Use violence. I like it. So,
Emery, we were just talking about secondary education colleges and everything, and Ron DeSantis getting rid of the DEI or diversity, equity, and inclusion positions at all the colleges and everything. So, and Emery and I are just having this conversation. This morning, I think, or right before noon, right before he got on the road. But give us your take on all these universities and everything standing up and talking about how Israel's committing genocide and the Palestinians are the oppressors and. Give us what you saw on the ground there last week.
Okay. All right. Well, there's really two things here in your question, right? One is about universities, and I have a lot to say about that. And the other is about what's actually going on the ground. So as far as the universities, you know, I'll tell you in from the direction of like my field, my research, my all that. I think Western society has been ripened for quite some time in terms of kind of how our society is kind of gearing up against each other. And And I think on one hand, that's an opening for evil actors to come in and do some persuasive stuff. The other side is we have to actually look at Qatar. And I know I automatically go back to that, but it's a fact, right? Qatar has single-handedly has spent billions. They have given billions and billions of dollars to American universities specifically. Now, this is not a new thing. They've been doing this for 30, 40 years, and they've been giving money directly to universities. They've also been doing through a lot of grants and stuff. You know, they've been paying for a lot of people's higher education and then kind of sucking them into their own workforce. And so, you know, that's a thing that's been going on. And money talks, right? When you go and give somebody a check with many, many, many zeros behind the one, then, you know, they conform to kind of what you want, right? And he who controls the money controls the narrative. And I think it's kind of that simple. That's one piece of it. The other piece, of course, you know, is our society is kind of, it's kind of cannibalizing itself right now. And to a degree, that's true for the entire Western world. So I think that's kind of a you know, we're doing it to ourselves, but also other people that don't want America to maintain its position in the world, you know, are finding the chinks in the armor to put that spear through. So, you know, I think we got some big issues. Our big thing, and we've been, you and I, Sue, have been saying this for years, well before this conflict started, we've been saying that we need to use our voices to help educate people in our country, A, to reconnect with our country and love our home again, and B, to bring people together and understand that if we don't do this together, the whole American experiment is not going to last that much longer. So
yeah, and we were kind of saying in our phone call this afternoon that you know, a lot of these people who are standing up and putting the keffiyeh on and standing in front of the Palestinian flag, and you know, they're saying Palestine, you know, stop the genocide in Palestine, including our own vice president, by the way. We need to have a ceasefire, which I'm totally against, because that's exactly what happened in Fallujah when years ago when I was in Iraq. They called for a ceasefire. They tried to let Médecins Sans Frontières, you know, Doctors Without Borders, and a lot of supposed NGOs or charity groups go into and take care of the people in Fallujah, and we caught them. You know, my Iraqi commandos and myself, we caught several mortar sites going in, or mortar rounds, or you know, just ammunition and stuff like that. It was disguised to kind of help them regroup, and this was you know, in April, so come November of the same year. Second battle of Fallujah, and it was bloody, bloody, bloody. And when we could have got that over a lot sooner and defeated them, like Israel's trying to do, if they can defeat Hamas, and we can get our people here in the United States to understand that there's when they're claiming for Palestinians and accusing of genocide, first you have to defeat Hamas, and then you deal with what's left of the Palestinians. I think, Emery, my question to you and what you need to tell our viewers here is why, and this goes clear back to the inception or the conception of Israel as a state. Why doesn't Lebanon and Egypt take all these refugees in? Why won't I've noticed that even Egypt down there toward Rafah, they won't open the gates and let the refugees into their country. Why hasn't anybody pointed that out to these college students here in the United States?
Right. Well, look, there's a few things in what you're saying. I'll start with the end, right? Because it's a phenomenal question, right? Why aren't countries, forget Lebanon a second, because Lebanon is in no place to be doing anything as a country. Lebanon is essentially run by Hezbollah right now. And they're broke and all this stuff. So Lebanon's out. The big question is mainly three countries, but there's a lot more. Jordan, Egypt, and Turkey. So all three of them have said, we will not take a single refugee, not one. It was Assisi, the president of Egypt, that said it first. Of course, the king of Jordan said it. We will not take a single one. What we have to understand first and foremost, the Arab world, the Arabs in the other countries, hate the Palestinians. They don't like them. They don't like them personally. They don't like them culturally. And they don't like that the Palestinians bring terror to wherever they go, right? And if you think I'm just talking out my ass, not you, Sue, because you know this, but you guys watching this, look at what happened in Jordan, right, in the 70s. You had a bunch of Palestinians go into there and, you know, claiming to be refugees. And then they started an internal war there. They started attacking Israel from Jordan. They started trying. So it was drawing Israeli attention into Jordan. And then they actually created a civil war. Look at what the Palestinians did in Lebanon. Same deal, created a civil war there. Look at what the Palestinians that went to Yemen did. Same thing, violence internally there. So that's one of the reasons that they don't want to take them. Another reason they won't take them is because by not accepting a single refugee, what you're doing is you're sticking Israel with that problem forever. And let's go back to why Israel originally had control of Gaza, which is the 1967 war, right? The Six-Day War. We essentially had to go through Gaza to interdict the Egyptian army that was coming up from the southern Suez, Sinai. So the Egyptian army's coming up from the Sinai. We had to go meet them. At the time, there were two roads to get there, and one of them went through Gaza. So there was some fighting in Gaza. It was kind of minimal, all things considered, went through there. Well, and we ended up conquering the entire Sinai Peninsula. A few years later, during the peace agreements, the peace talks with Egypt, we gave back all of their land that they asked for, right? I mean, we took it in the war, but we had no intention of keeping it, including Gaza. But Egypt refused to take back Gaza because Gaza was a crappy place in terms of economically. It was horrible, and it was a pain in the Egyptians' ass. The Gazan people are not cohesive with the rest of the Egyptian people, not to speak of the fact that there's an actual geographic separation between mainland Egypt and where Gaza is. And so those are essentially the reasons why they don't want to take the Palestinians into the other countries, right? Namely, the two things. They don't want those people in their countries because historically they've been a problem to them. And you keep Israel occupied with having to deal with the Gazans. So those are the two main things, and nobody's paying attention. You said a bunch more things there, Sue, that are very accurate. I want to address the ceasefire thing. Here, it's easy to sell the idea of a ceasefire based on the words ceasefire, right? An American or Western ears hear the term ceasefire, and what do you think? You think, okay, they're going to stop fighting, and here we go. We have peace. What people don't understand is a few things. First of all, we have to defeat this enemy, period, because anything short of absolute annihilation of Hamas, and I'm saying Hamas, not the greater Arab people in Gaza, right? And we'll get to that in a second because it's very difficult, nearly impossible to make that separation. But the war is against Hamas. And if we do anything short of absolutely annihilate them, then in their eyes, they won the war. So a lot of people would say, well, who cares what they think? What they think very much matters, because if they put out even the rhetoric of we won this war, then that puts committing terrorist acts like October the 7th, that puts that on the map for the rest of people with terrorist aspirations, right? So if Hamas, if any of the Hamas people make it out of this alive, and they say, hey, look, we won, the Jewish Satan couldn't defeat us, then the rest of the Arab world can say, hey, look, this works. It's a victory in our book, and keep going. And it's that simple in terms of the ceasefire. In addition, there are points like
exactly.
you're making.
Soon. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. No, I just want to iterate on that. You're exactly right. We've already learned this in Iraq and Afghanistan. You know, we pulled out of Iraq too early and too fast, and we just created a vacuum for ISIS to start again. And during Obama's 8 years, millions, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people were murdered by ISIS. People that we went in there, we stabilized the country, and we tried to protect. Afghanistan the same way. Look at our pullout with the Biden administration with Afghanistan. You know, now the Taliban's back. The very people that protected Osama bin Laden and gave us 9/11, they are back in control of the country, richer and more equipped than they ever been. So total failure on American, when we talk about not American military, but American statesmanship, we failed. So
yeah, it comes down to politics. It comes down to the politicians always. If you look at, you know, all the failures, and I view them as failures, the previous engagements that Israel's had in Gaza over the last decade, you know, every time we go in and take care of some stuff and blow up some, you know, some rocket firing locations and destroy some weapons caches and whatever, kill a couple of terrorists, but we're not letting the military do what it needs to do, right? There's no definitive win, right? Nobody can give you a definition of a definitive win in a war anymore, right? If you think about it in terms of a politician, they're not giving the military clear enough guidelines in terms of, I need you to go in here. If I'm telling the military, I need you to go in here and I need you to destroy Hamas, you let the military go and do its thing. And you can't tell them, hey, hold that street and wait there until we tell you to move, and then let a bunch of soldiers sit on a street corner open to you know, artillery fire and Cornet missiles. Right? You're not going to let them sit there for a couple of days unless you're a dirty politician and you really have no business deciding tactical maneuvers. Right. So, but that's the thing. So when you have something like, you know, our withdrawal from Afghanistan, any way you turn it, the withdrawal from Afghanistan is going to leave a mark, right? It's going to be kind of a nasty scene. Trump had already started having a plan, right? He had a timeline for pulling out of there. And but Biden came in, wanted to do it better now just to show that Trump's a piece of shit and, you know, whatever, and created this mess. And it took us really, in terms of the effectiveness of what we had done there for 20 years, it took us to before the war even, you know. So that's a big issue.
Out of the jaws of victory, we grabbed defeat. Yeah, it was a total defeat. You got to admit that. Yeah. So.
Right.
Yeah. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Chris has lost his internet. Let's take a quick break. We'll run a quick commercial and we'll come back because this is some really awesome stuff. Is that okay with you guys?
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely, all right. Rush. All right.
Folks, the early bird tickets is over, so you'll be paying full price because you waited too long. Emery, Sue, go ahead. We do have a couple of questions in the thing. When you're ready to, we'll read them out. Just call me in.
Yeah, go ahead, Russ. Because I first of all, I apologize to everybody on you know, I'm on my phone here because I'm on the road. I just got to Carl's to pick him up. We're going to Palatka in the morning. So yay, because we're going to RCPT and we're going to jump out of some airplanes. But so I say that because I can't read on my phone the notes.
Absolutely. So Patrick Seven, he says, what are your guys' thoughts about that relief convoy in Gaza that got stormed by the zombies and everyone freaked out when the people that were supposed to hand out food refused to be beat to death? Emery, this is right up your alley, yeah. Buddy.
Yeah. All right. Thank you, Russ. And thanks, Patrick, for the question. It's a great question. So, look, this is not the first time that's happened. Israel has been providing humanitarian aid to Gaza, first of all, throughout this entire war, but also since 2005, when we pulled out all our the military forces, as well as all of the Jewish settlements. We pulled them out by force, the Jewish people. We pulled them out by force from the Gaza Strip. From that day, we have been providing all building materials, food, electricity, drinking water, medicine, all that stuff. We've been sending to Gaza every day. Every day there have been tons and tons of trucks. So this whole skewed, weird, kind of narrative that the world has put, oh, well, Israel's created this humanitarian disaster. Israel's the only reason it's not become a humanitarian disaster in the first place. Now let me get to your question, Patrick. In this war specifically, this is not the time, not the first time, first of all, that that Jordan has airdropped stuff into Gaza, right? They started that a couple months ago already, where Jordan did drive-bys with a C-130 and dropped a bunch of MREs or whatever. From the start of this thing, they have been doing that. When Hamas has guys with guns shooting at hungry people to not storm the vehicles, that's the only time they don't get stormed. But then what happens is all of those supplies go to Hamas. None of them make it to the people. And so Hamas is single-handedly making those people starve to death. All we have to do to end this war is for Hamas tomorrow morning to say, we give up, we turn ourselves in. They save their lives and the war is over, right? But no, they're cynically using their own civilians in order to perpetuate this narrative and turn up the volume on this narrative internationally, that the Jews suddenly are the Nazis, which, right, you couldn't make
it
dumber.
It's not a new tactic. It's not a new tactic. I saw that back in Somalia, yeah, back in Bosnia, back in Iraq. I mean, this is a tactic that has been used since probably as long as warfare. You know, he who controls the food controls the population. It's that simple. All right. So this is nothing new. It's just that our new people that report this have a way of twisting it around and pointing the finger at Israel and saying, well, it's all your fault, to put pressure, yep, on it and try to get that ceasefire that we said won't work.
Yeah, 100%, Sue. You're 100% on. And let me quote Napoleon. Napoleon said, the army marches on its stomach, and nothing could be more true. And that's true of not just an army. The army has to be fed. Hamas has to be fed. Hamas is stealing all the food, even though we have found enormous underground stockpiles. But that's 100% accurate. So, by the way, when in history, Sue, you're much better versed than I am at history. When in history ever was there a war where one side actually provided food, shelter, medicine, all of that to the other side? I've never heard of it. Right, I've never heard of it. Go ahead, Sue.
You can say Sue. Never. So, no, not that I know. I mean, we talk. For those of you who talk about the humanitarian part of it, like we did a special on tactical riflemen, or a video on tactical riflemen, on the prisoners of war and the surviving SEER school is what it was called. But they teach you all the way back to the American Revolution and even before that, the prisoners were starved to death in prison barges and everything during the revolution. Israel, when it captures these people, those Hamas terrorists are treated better than they ever were before the war started. I mean, and you notice that one of the things that Hamas is demanding to engage in a ceasefire is they'll decide how few or you know how they'll release some of the 120 hostages, but they want those prisoners back, you know, that are actually eating right. Well right now and not starving to death. Like I'm sure
college degrees.
The hostages aren't eating that well. I almost guarantee you that.
Oh, I can guarantee it. Guaranteed. I met with some of the hostage families on both of my trips there. I've got a lot of information. They're obviously not treated very well. Not to speak of the ongoing, you know, rape and all the crazy things that they have to deal with, you know, while in captivity. To get back to the food thing, look, you have a lot of hungry people. You have a lot of hungry people who come from a culture that teaches violence. And I know it sounds bad, but it is bad. It is bad. This is an entire culture that teaches from day one, right? With mother's milk, they drink hate and kill the Jews, right? And so you have a culture that's built around this kind of aggressive personality. What do you think is going to happen when you drop a truck with, you know, with supplies to a bunch of hungry people who grew up like that, right? Do the people of Gaza deserve it? I mean, deserve the horrible situation they're in? I would say for the most part, probably not. I'd like to believe that there's a lot of good people living there. I kind of doubt it because we know that Hamas has the recent polls, you know, even after the war, they're asking a lot of people and they're saying that 70 to 80% of Gazans still approve of Hamas and all that. What's up, Carl? And if I were an NGO guy and I was asked to go ride one of these trucks and hand out food, I would say, fuck no, right? I wouldn't do it. Not to speak of the fact that the NGOs aren't really doing anything productive outside of specifically and exactly helping Hamas. You look at UNRWA, you look at the Red Cross, right? They are directly helping Hamas. UNRWA, of course, much more directly than the Red Cross. The Red Cross is trying to keep that, hey, we're the good guys everywhere and we like to hug trees, but really they are every bit as Nazi as these Hamas bastards are. You want some examples? Great. How about they were, what is their job? There are hostages in a place, Gaza. One time, the International Red Cross hasn't even made contact with a hostage to see if they're okay. They haven't given Israel any information that they have on hostages, whereabouts, if they're okay. The International Red Cross has been given the medicine, right, to give to these hostages. Just give them the medicine. They know how to self-medicate, whatever. Not one piece of that medicine has gotten to them. And we have found many of those bags of medicine, pill bottles, with the people's names on them, kept in different places that we have taken over from Hamas. So all of these NGOs that are there, and UNRWA, oh man, we need another 6 hours just to talk about those Nazi bastards. The UN in general needs to be dismantled. Should have been done 50 years ago. The UN's been nothing but a warmongering, you know, bunch of assholes that are putting, you know, who's on the UN Human Rights Council, right? The Human Rights Council of the United Nations. Who's on there? Most recently it was headed up by Iran, right? You've had Gaddafi sitting there. You have all these nations that kill the most people, the most of their own people. And those are who sits on UN Human Rights Council, right? So NGOs in this sense, there are plenty of good NGOs on the planet. Not one of them is working in the Middle East, in an effective way, unless you see effective as aiding a terrorist organization. So that's that. And the airdrops now that now Biden has done, right? At first, it was just Jordan. Okay, whatever. Let them have it, right? But now America and followed by France are airdropping these supplies into Gaza because nobody's going to set foot in there. And that to me is another nail in the coffin that Joe Biden is putting into the relationship with Israel. He is specifically saying, not verbally, but with actions, that he wants for the destruction of Israel. Joe Biden's also in a terribly difficult place, right? By the way, let me caveat this. When I say Joe Biden, I don't mean the man, because there is no man, right? He's a M&M shell. But the Biden administration, what they're doing is is very specifically trying to essentially make Israel lose while not looking like it to the American voters. Everybody in Israel understands exactly what's going on this side. We, the Americans, don't have enough experience overseas and over there to necessarily understand exactly what's going on. But the Biden administration, first of all, who makes the decisions? And I'm not talking about, you know, the whole, you know, Obama's running the government or whatever. What I'm talking about is who are the people in the Biden administration who make all these decisions about the Middle East specifically? And the answer is they are historically anti-Semitic, pro-Hamas, very specifically people well before this war, right? A couple of them are actually Arabs from the Middle East, right? And those are the people, and they've been outwardly, who was it? I don't want to butcher his name, and I can't remember his name specifically. But one of his top aides, who is the guy responsible for the State Department / White House in terms of going out and doing all this stuff and telling Blinken what to say, you know, a few years ago was calling for America to change the law, about working with terrorist organizations or how to decide someone's a terrorist organization in order to normalize relations with Hamas, literally. Yep.
And he's also the same one that won't let Congress, you know, even get into committee about putting the Mexican drug cartels on the terrorist watch list. I mean, they're terrorists. Come on, let's admit it. They're all working together, and there's so much we could talk about. We could talk for hours. We've gone over our time here. I don't know if we should jump off here. Are you going to be available next week? We can continue this.
Next week, I may or may not. What we can do, guys, here's what we'll do. A, if I can make it next week, I will. I'll be at Palatka, so I'll be talking to you guys if I can from the drop zone. Now that I'm in the States, I at least have connectivity. And if not, Sue, let's you and I do a whole nother video that we'll let Chris put up on this channel if he wants. And if not, we'll put it elsewhere for you guys to watch.
Yeah, we can do a question and answer on this whole subject, because I totally agree with you. And at the present time, I think it's important to put out not only to the viewers here on Angry American, but wherever we can get a platform, is just to educate the people. All they have to do is look back what's happened over the last 20 years and even the people that were in the military with me. Have we ever really won anything? Yeah, we've won militarily. Right, but we've always come back home by aiding and abetting and empowering the very thing that we went there to destroy. You know, whether it's Saddam Hussein, whether it's the Taliban, whether it's you know, Al Qaeda, or whether it's Al Qaeda in Iraq, they're all stronger. So listening to the current administration, who's just been trained for 20 years in losing. Nobody should follow their advice, and I'm glad to see that the government of Israel is not following them. They're holding out under a lot of pressure for the ceasefire, but they need to hold out until they win a victory. They have to defeat Hamas, or they're just going to be dealing with this in another 4 or 5 years.
Yeah, and 100%. And guys, I want you to understand every word Sue just said is 100% accurate. But let me add to it that if Israel doesn't defeat Hamas now, even if it does, this shit is coming here, and it's coming here in a few disturbing ways. It's already here. It's just the timing isn't right for them to essentially cook it off yet. Understand it's here. It's here. It's in France. It's in Germany, and rest assured, it's here in America.
All right, Russ, with that, you got anything else for the audience?
Well, guys, thank you for picking up the slack. Chris is mad as a wet hen right now about his internet issues. It wouldn't surprise me if he's throwing stuff around the hotel room. We will not have a Facebook Live tomorrow night. Chris will be traveling home from New Orleans. I'm not sure if we're going to do a podcast next week. I think there's a pre-record because he'll be traveling up to Kentucky, where we'll be for the short term throughout March. We'll be in Hinman, Kentucky on the 13th through the 15th, and then over in Bowling Green the following weekend. And then who knows where he's going to end up after that. But, guys, thanks again, and we'll catch you guys next time.